So I want to start with Colorado politics, and we'll branch out, you know, to national stuff too. But I know you've been following the Colorado Senate race for Cory Gardner's seat. What stands out to you about this race?
Well, this is probably the hottest Senate race in the country in this cycle. This is the one that Democrats want the most and where they feel like they have a really good shot. And obviously, Republicans and Cory Gardner think that they have a path. But, you know, he won in 2014, which was a really terrible year for Democrats. It was a midterm year in the Obama administration. Most of the Democrats who were facing tough races that year lost. And Cory Gardner was one of the candidates who won. And so now, 6 years later, it is a different year. It's not a midterm. It's a presidential year. And the dynamics are very different than they were when he and a lot of these other senators were first elected.
And Democrats really do feel like they have an advantage in the fact that John Hickenlooper, who was running for president, has decided he's no longer running for president and is actually now going to be contesting the Senate race here. I mean, this is something that, not to sort of broaden too much out into presidential politics, but there are other candidates who have been receiving pressure to do the same, saying that, look, you know, for Democrats nationally, there are wins to be gained in the Senate. And this is a state in particular where, to Tam's point, I mean, Democrats feel like they have a good shot, but they also think it is a crucial state for them if they have any hopes of taking back the Senate.
Exactly. And, you know, we've been hearing this is considered one of the most vulnerable Senate seats in the nation. Is that what you're hearing?
Absolutely. And, you know, if you look at the Cook Political Report and their rankings, this is one of those seats, along with Maine is another one where it's considered potentially vulnerable. But if you look at this state in 2016, President Trump fared worse than any Republican as a percentage of the electorate that he won. He fared worse than any Republican since George H.W. Bush. And as a result, you know, there's some question about whether, and Republicans will argue, no, Colorado is still very much a purple state. But there's some question about just how purple that hue really is. And this Senate race is going to be a really good test of that.
And I mean, this is probably no news flash to you all or to any of your listeners, but I covered, you know, demographics. And I was going to say the demographics of Colorado is part of this. And a major part is the fact that there are a number of college educated voters who have moved to this state, non-native Coloradans who have changed the demographic makeup of this state, who tend to lean more liberal, tend to vote more for the Democratic Party.
Right. One thing that's interesting about the state of Colorado is this state has not had a female senator before. And so 7 of the candidates on the Democratic side are women. But as we just mentioned, you know, former Colorado Governor Hickenlooper is really considered the front runner. Just curious what you make of that.
Right. And then Andrew Romanoff is the other candidate who is a guy who is considered like the top challenger to Hickenlooper.
Sure.
You know, Iowa went a really long time without having a woman elected statewide or in its congressional delegation. Went a very long time. And then all of a sudden, that changed. And now there's Joni Ernst as the senator from Iowa, and a couple of women won congressional races in 2018. Sometimes it just takes a little while.
Yeah, I mean, I think of, you know, even Massachusetts, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Tam, but I believe that when Senator Elizabeth Warren won in 2012, that's the first time that Massachusetts had elected a woman to the U.S. Senate as well. And people think of Massachusetts as being this extremely blue, liberal state.
Progressive,
And so to me, there has been sort of a slow change, but maybe one that's been sort of expedited in the last decade or so around more women being elected or even running for the Senate.
What are you going to be watching for in the Colorado Senate race as it moves forward?
I don't know. That's a tough question. I mean, to your point, I think that John Hickenlooper is really seen as the front runner. He has a lot of name recognition in the state. And by him entering the race, to me, it did sort of change the dynamic of what many folks had maybe seen to be as a potentially more open seat on the Democratic side. So, you know, I don't know really what I'll be looking for in particular. I mean, I think one of the interesting questions always when there's somebody who's deemed to be a front runner is just really how resilient they are. And that's a question in the presidential election I've been really looking at when we have a sort of clear front runner there at that point, is just sort of how resilient they are, because it does become very difficult when name ID for the front runner is so high for some of the lesser known candidates to just even build enough name ID that they start tracking higher in the polls.
Yeah. So I have a couple of questions about this race. One is John Hickenlooper didn't want to run for Senate. At least that's what he said repeatedly and publicly on camera. And I do wonder how much of a problem that is going to be for him, assuming he does get the nomination. The other question is, how much of a fight is it for him to get the nomination? He does have this name ID, but he hasn't fully cleared the field. And at least some of the people who are running in the race don't intend to walk away. And there's some question about whether he is too moderate or too pro-business for the Democratic electorate in Colorado. And I don't know whether that will become an issue for him or not. And with Gardner, I guess what I'm watching for is, are there any moments where he separates himself from President Trump or not? He ran initially as this sort of, I'm going to be a moderate. I'm going to go to Washington. I'm going to work with Democrats. We're going to get things done. He has, you know, his campaign would tout his bipartisan voting record. Democrats would say, oh, no, it's not bipartisan. He votes with Trump all the time. Is there a path for a Republican who puts themselves at like arm's distance from President Trump? Is there a path for a Republican in a purple state? I don't know.
And we were talking about Colorado being a purple state for a long time. It does seem like it's changing. I'm curious if you see this in other states. Like, are you seeing shifts in other states?
Oh,
like
very
this?
Much mm-hmm. so. The map, I think, is totally changing. I mean, I think that's one of the most exciting things about having covered, you know, the 2016 cycle to now, is that I would argue the entire path to victory for a Republican candidate and a Democratic candidate has fundamentally changed. I mean, for a long time, Democrats would talk about a blue wall in the Midwest, and that would be your traditional, quote unquote, Rust Belt states.
Yep.
I feel like I can say the Rust Belt because I'm from the Midwest. But it would be
But just don't call it flyover country.
People would say, you know, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and even to some degree Ohio, that I would say Ohio had been trending more and more Republican. Those states are states that Donald Trump won in 2016, and the Democrats do see that, you know, they need to make inroads in, but Donald Trump also sees those states as being increasingly tilting more in his favor than, say, Republican 20 years ago would have. On the flip side, you know, there are states all around the Sun Belt, and I would include Colorado kind of in that category, being, you know,
sun
I know,
is very
the sun.
Bright, I can attest. My nose can attest.
But that would be, you know, North Carolina, Colorado, Arizona, Nevada,
Florida,
Florida-ish, right? These are states that are demographically trending more towards the Democratic Party. And what I mean by that is you have a larger percentage of non-white voters in those states, and you also have a larger percentage of white college-educated voters. And those two groups in particular have seemed to be tilting further away from President Trump.
What is it like to cover politics for NPR and travel around and hang out with these candidates?
Well, I'm covering the Democratic field this election cycle, so it feels really different than what I did in 2016 when I covered demographics, which meant I spent a lot of time both with Republicans and Democrats. You know, on the Democratic side, it's a really crowded primary still. So I think one of the interesting things has just been to sort of understand where and what matters to Democratic primary voters this election cycle. To me, there's not entirely consensus around that idea. Often what I've heard from folks is that they want someone who will beat President Trump.
I've heard it too, and I'm not even covering the Democrats that often.
That is something I've heard from a lot of folks, but I don't think that there's consensus amongst voters about what it will take to get a candidate who will beat Donald Trump. Like, there is not agreement on what that actually means.
It is so much fun to go do these voter interviews where you're like, so what's most important to you? And they say, oh, beating President Trump. That is the most important. I need somebody who's electable. We want to beat President Trump. Well, what does that mean to you exactly? And there's just like people don't know. Nobody knows what it is, and everybody is.
And those who do, they disagree, right? Like, some people will say, that means we need somebody who's really passionate, who's really progressive,
yes,
is going to have all these big, bold ideas. And other people will say, like, no, we need somebody who's just going to, like, kind of play it safe. I've heard some people say really, like, blunt statements around gender and race,
yes,
as well, around, you know, we need a white man and because a white man can take on a white man.
And you know what? I've heard that from a lot of older white women.
So when you're trying to ferret out what people's priorities are, it kind of sounds like it's all coming down to this one thing, electability.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so just to be clear, I'm covering President Trump's reelection.
No, but I'm curious, though, from Tam's perspective, because I do think there's so much focus on the Democrats this election cycle as to what is even happening in, like, the campaign world of President Trump. Because I do think I'm so constantly focused on the Democrats, and that's where most of the attention is right now because there's just 19 people running.
Yeah, so while everyone's focused on the Democrats, President Trump and the Republicans are quietly building a reelection machine that is nothing like the band of pirates that they had in 2016. You know, like, to talk to the Republican Party and state Republicans and the Trump campaign is shockingly similar to talking to Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. They're talking about organizing. They're talking about building relationships with voters and having those voters bring in their friend group. They're doing voter registration drives. While the Democrats are running against each other, they're running for reelection. And it is fascinating. Just the way they talk about it is so similar to the way I've heard Democrats talk about building campaign operations that it's really, really quite interesting.
It's also fascinating for me to hear you talk about state party operations, just totally not even embracing President Trump, but moving beyond that, that they are the organization that is essentially helping him build his reelection campaign, because there were so many questions for so long about, you know, Donald Trump being this outlier Republican candidate.
Yeah.
And that's all moot at this
point.
Oh,
my God. It is his party.
Yeah.
Through and through.
Asma, I know in 2016 you produced a reporter's notebook about what it was like to be out there and talking to voters and covering the 2016 presidential campaign and experiencing racism. And I'm just curious how your experience has been during this campaign cycle.
So this campaign cycle so far has been fundamentally different, in part because I am covering Democrats mostly this election cycle. And the Democratic electorate is much more diverse than the Republican electorate. And so when you're at campaign events, there are many different races already there. And so you don't sort of stick out like a sore thumb in the same way that I would have. And I did at Trump rallies. It was very obvious as to who I was. Even ahead of the 2018 midterms, I covered a number of Republican events. I was at local Republican Party's Christmas party in Ohio. And I had gotten the in to come in through somebody I had interviewed and talked to a bunch of times. But I know multiple people at that party started asking, who is she? Why is she here? Those types of things don't really happen to me anymore. And I mean, there's a lot more to discuss about why and what the party is and those makeups. But I think that it's a totally different experience. But look, I think part of what that tells me is that, and I guess if I think about it too much, I actually think it's really problematic, because what that actually speaks to is how fundamentally racially polarized the electorate is. Mm-hmm. That I can exist in certain spaces as a total, like, non-issue. Nobody even pays attention, really, to the fact that you're there, versus in other spaces, it's very apparent that you're there. And to me, that speaks to really big, broader political issues, but also sort of like civic issues about a country that really racially is extremely politically segregated at this point.
Well, and race is, there's definite like political racial segregation. There are, covering Republicans, I would go days without seeing a person of color. Like, if you're in the bubble with a Republican campaign, you can go a very long time without seeing a person of color, and it feels weird. It's just because, like, you'll be in states and places where you know that it is diverse, and yet because you're in the campaign bubble, you're in this space that is so incredibly white, and it feels just so strange.
So remarkable to me, because that's also really, I think, just for like citizenship and sort of civic duty, really problematic, because you have a country where, like, you know, we talk about, we have young kids, like, our kids are growing up in a world where to be white is to be a minority. Mm-hmm. And at this point, it's sort of like, ooh, our politics, though, don't really embrace what our kids' worlds look like.
But there's also, and this relates to demographics too, but there's this growing rural-urban divide in our politics that play out in Colorado politics as well, where, you know, we're in Boulder right now. You go to Denver, it is as blue as can be. You'd never know that there were Republicans in this state. But there are, and they're in the more rural parts.
And I know that you both have experience covering the presidential election in 2016, where the press is kind of considered the enemy.
And I cover the White House. So I work in a place where we literally get called the enemy of the people like every other day. And at first I was a little bit bothered by it. And from a civic perspective, from a safety perspective, from a faith in our institutions perspective, it is wildly problematic to have a president of the United States actively denigrate the media or the press. And it's scary. But in terms of day to day, how I do my job, how I think about my reporting, the best way to prove him wrong is not to go out there and join the resistance. The best way to prove him wrong is to do good journalism. And so, I mean, like, if anything, all it does is make me just want to put my head down and work harder and expose light. And, you know, like, certainly because this is a presidency where, or a president where he says things that aren't true a lot. You know, I have in some ways changed the way I do a story in that, you know, if he is saying something that's not true and it's relevant and it's important, like, you can't just ignore it. So I've changed the way I write so that I call it a fact sandwich where we...
yeah, you kind of like say what isn't true, you say what he said, and then you repeat that that's not true.
Yeah.
Is that the fact?
That's it. That's the fact sandwich.
It's important.
But it's that is how my job has changed.
I'd like to ask you both quickly just about doing the podcast too. You know, you both report on politics and traditional, you know, story for NPR fashion, but what does the format of the podcast allow you to do differently from traditional reporting?
You want to take that first?
I just talked, so I was thinking it would be your
turn. Okay, sure.
So this is, and this is how the podcast works.
It's a remarkably more casual format. And, you know, we sort of joke and say that it's akin to like me going up to Tam's desk and telling her like, oh my God, this just happened. I saw this story.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah. But that is really fundamentally accurate, I would say. Like, we pop into a studio and it is essentially as if the listeners are kind of a fly on the wall as we're talking through story ideas, talking through issues that have happened. It's a really casual format, but to me, I think more than even the format, what I have loved about the podcast is so often I will go out to cover events and I am stopped particularly by young people who say, I love the podcast. I listen to the podcast all the time. And we were just talking about civic journalism and responsibility. I will say, I feel for young folks. Like, I don't know that people fundamentally trust where to always get their news. They don't listen to or read loads of news outlets. So for us to be like a trusted news source for young folks, younger than me. I'm not that young anymore. I feel really honored about that. I mean, I think that that's an amazing, amazing responsibility that we have that, you know, like teenagers who can't even vote are listening to the podcast as a place to get news. And they don't necessarily go to loads of other places to get that political information.
Yeah, our audience definitely skews younger. And our podcast is definitely conversational and it's fun. And I think that that sort of approach to covering politics where we are having a fun conversation. We don't assume a level of knowledge. We always make sure that that we aren't talking down to people, but we also aren't talking over their heads. So we very quickly try to like dispense with whatever background is needed to make sure that our conversation makes sense to anyone anywhere. If you just landed from your alien spaceship and showed up, you would understand what we were talking about. But I also think that having done the podcast has in some ways changed the way we are on the air. I always felt like, you know, when you're on the radio, you're like, oh, you're this like very authoritative, buttoned up. Yeah. And I think that by proving to ourselves and to our editorial structure that we can have intelligent political conversation that is more human, we've been able to bring that humanity to our other reporting.
You know, there's a lot of coverage. It feels like, you know, they talk about the proverbial fire hose of information. Do you have advice for how people can kind of best sort through this deluge of information?
My thoughts are, we drink from the fire hose so you don't have to. And I think that politics has in some ways replaced sports and hobbies and like things that are good for you. And it has replaced, you know, the releases and the relaxation. And people are so into it and so wound up that I worry about people. Like, it is our job to be obsessed with politics. Mm-hmm. Other people have jobs and families. And part of me says, like, you know, sip. Take a sip. Don't drink from the – you don't have to drink from the fire hose. Take sips. Listen to the NPR Politics podcast. Read when you feel like reading. Don't go into the social media vortex. Just, you know, go to your favorite news organization website or go to your favorite newspaper and read the news once a day, twice a day, not all day.
How do you step away and get away from this? It is your job.
I run. I run until I am tired and no longer on edge. I run. I cook.
I had a baby recently, and I think that that helps put a lot of things in perspective, I will say. It makes me realize also why I want to cover politics. And I know that sounds sort of grandiose, but look, the country and our politics right now has developed an extremely like racialized edge. And my kid is a little brown boy growing up in this country. And I think that there is like an element of that that has made me feel like this job is very important. But also at the end of the day, when I step home, I go hours sometimes. I hope my editor doesn't mind, but I go hours sometimes without checking my phone until I put him to bed and we have some time for ourselves. And I think that that's important.
I think that's really good advice for all of us. Thank you both so much. Tamara Keith is a White House correspondent for NPR. Asma Khalid is a political correspondent covering the 2020 presidential campaign. Both of you, co-hosts of the NPR Politics podcast. We're so glad you could join us today.
You're welcome.
Our pleasure.